So welcome everyone to the Tuesday Berkman Lunch Series. We have a wonderful guest today in Professor Michael Heller from Columbia. We'll hear more about him in a moment, but welcome to anyone for whom this is the first Berkman Tuesday Lunch. It's an informal session with somebody brilliant and wonderful leading conversation, but hopefully then extending into an animated back and forth, which we hope you'll participate in. This is being webcast as well as recorded for later viewing, so you're on the record. We hope people will be on the record, but if you don't care to be, you are so warned. And in Berkman welcoming fashion, maybe just so Professor Heller knows who we all are, we'll just go around and give him some intros, and then I will introduce him and take it from there. But Jim, would you mind starting off the self-introductions?
Sure. I guess I should be consistent with the previous time. I was here last time. I'm Jim Van Ecko is my name. I've had a career that's covered a multitude of sins, and I have activities now that cover a multitude of sins. Last time I introduced myself as a freelance sociologist. That's reasonable enough.
Sounds good.
I'm Victoria Stodden, and I'm a fellow here at Berkman on the Internet and Democracy Project.
I'm Jim Besson, BU Law School. Thanks for the book.
Thank you.
I've co-authored a book on patents recently. Spoke here about it.
David Larchell, Berkman staff.
I'm Luckman Choi. I'm a senior fellow here.
Esther Hargitay, I'm a fellow here.
I'm Ethan Zuckerman. I'm a fellow here.
I'm David Arty. I'm a fellow and director of the Citizen Media Law Project.
I'm Brendan Ballou. I'm an intern.
I'm Becca Tabaski on staff here at Berkman.
Jason Kaufman. I'm a fellow.
Corina DiGennaro. I'm a fellow.
Melanie Dulon. I'm a fellow here working on the Collective Librarians Project.
Robin Brisson, staff.
Yeah, Eric Engel. I work for Carolyn Nolan and Bibis.
John Poffman,
Joris van Hoboek, I'm a visiting researcher from the Netherlands.
Chris Segoy, I'm a fellow here.
Adam Holland, I'm a research assistant here.
I'm Tony Pino, I'm a student at the college.
I'm Virginia Rutter, I'm a sociologist.
Tyler Warren, I'm a fellow at the Center for Research on Computational Society and Computer Science Department.
Right. Alan Friedman, also a fellow of the Computer Science Department.
Andrew Russell, I'm a PhD in the sociology department.
Mark Belsey, a Harvard Extension graduate.
Benyan Jamus, an intern at the Berkman Center.
Yochai Benkler, faculty.
Berkman Center, I'm a Rasher.
Great.
David Weinberger, I'm a fellow at the center.
David Ashman.
Eric Jackson, I'm a local software engineer.
Excellent. So it's our great pleasure that Professor Heller has come to join us for the book tour, in part for him and for the lecture series and discussion series we have here. For those who don't know his background, he's one of the best-known property law experts. And as you may know, in our conversations around the Berkman Center, there's often this slightly uneasy conversation about whether what we usually talk about in property law translates into this weird world of intellectual property and the web and so forth. And in this book, Professor Heller, I think, has done a wonderful job of making that translation make sense in ways that seem intuitive and smart and interesting. Our friend and collaborator Lawrence Lessig has the lead quote on the front of the book, which tipped me off that I was probably going to like it. But it's quite the case that as I made my way through it, it became quite clear that Professor Heller has a huge amount to offer to our conversation. The book that he's written covers a range of topics outside the cyber law zone. It covers a lot of things, for instance, relevant to the Petrie Flom Center upstairs and health and biotech and so forth, in particular through the patent lens, which I'm sure he'll touch upon. But the cross-cutting notion that he presents in this book about the extent to which private ownership, which usually is thought to create wealth, in fact may have the opposite effect of creating gridlock, is a thesis that I think we need to understand, push back on, and learn from. So, Professor Heller, thank you again so much for being here, and we look forward to hearing more about this great book.
John, thank you for that warm introduction. It's also nice to meet all of you, just even for a second. This is usually you face a room and you have no idea. So thank you all for introducing yourselves. So let me give you just in one sentence the nutshell version of the book. And the nutshell is this. When too many people own pieces of one thing, nobody can use it. That's it. When too many people own pieces of one thing, nobody can use it. Right? So usually we think of private property as generating wealth, and usually that's right. But too much ownership has the opposite effect. It creates gridlock. So that's a paradox in the free market that I discovered, and it's the core of our gridlock economy of this book. When too many people own pieces of a single resource, cooperation breaks down, wealth disappears, everybody loses. And I want to give you a couple of examples outside of cyberspace that maybe will sort of jar your thinking or prompt your thinking, and then we can circle back to the cyberspace area. So, 3 weeks ago, Bill Clinton was asked, how do you explain the current economic meltdown? And his answer was very gratifying to me. He said, to understand the current economic crisis, read The Gridlock Economy. which is nice, because I didn't send him the book. I don't know how he got it. And I also wrote the book before the current economic crisis. And yet, and so I was puzzled why that was his answer. And the reason that was his answer is that the current economic crisis shares the same underlying structure as many other areas at the cutting edge of innovation and the cutting edge of major losses to our economy. So it used to be that lenders and borrowers knew each other. And if you got in trouble as a borrower, you had someone to phone at the other end of the line. Banks never liked to foreclose. They always lost money on foreclosure. And what they would prefer to do, and typically did, was work out the loan with you so that you stayed in your home, but you changed the terms of the loan. In a new world where mortgages are pooled and tranched and turned into bonds, you now have potentially several thousand owners of a single mortgage, several thousand fragment owners, and they cannot renegotiate a loan. So mass foreclosure became inevitable in this country when you had a nationwide downturn. The servicers of those loans could handle one or two people having their loans go bad, but they couldn't handle thousands at once. So that's an example of gridlock. And the problem there is too many owners of fragments of mortgages mean that we have the larger meltdown that we're seeing. That's one type of example in securities. Here's a second one that may be a little closer to home. Jim Besson writes about this in his book. And this is an area of drug patents. I was talking here with the CEO, the chief of research at one of the big pharma companies. He's pretty sure he has a treatment that's a major advance for Alzheimer's, but he couldn't bring it to market. Because for this particular treatment, he needed access to dozens of patented neurotransmitter pathways in the brain. This wasn't an area his firm had done a lot of work in before, so they owned very few of them. Imagine this guy walking into a room like this one. Imagine every one of you is a small biotech startup, and each of you has a patent that you think is the key to Alzheimer's, and you have it sitting on your lap, and it's your pride and joy. The big pharma guy needs to negotiate successfully with every single one of you before he can go forward. Because these neurotransmitters occur in nature, he can't work around your patents. He either has access to your patent or he can't go forward. And what happens there is that he didn't go forward. And the reason he called me up is that he had put this treatment on the shelf, even though he was fairly confident it would save millions of lives and earn his company billions of dollars. He couldn't make the deal. And that turns out not to be an isolated case. There's in the last 30 years in America, we've seen a steady increase up and up and up of investment in basic drug R&D. We had a shift in the underlying patent law that made it easier to patent life forms. We had a shift in the incentives for universities to commercialize their research. So what you've seen, for example, in the last 30 years is the creation of about 40,000 DNA-related patents from none. So we have a tremendous amount more patenting and investment in the drug area. That's gone steadily up and up and up over the last generation. But what's gone down are major new classes of drugs that treat disease. We have more and more patenting in precursors to drug treatment, but fewer and fewer pills in a bottle that actually cure people from diseases. I call that the drug discovery gap, and the reason for that discovery gap is a second example of gridlock. In this case, it's all these patent owners of upstream products potentially blocking each other from the downstream discoveries that actually save human life. We have drugs that could exist, that don't, because of the problem of gridlock. It's not just drugs where we see the problem of gridlock. All across the high-tech frontier, we're seeing this problem. Let me give you a third example, which is in the area of telecom. Some of you here may work on telecom. Let me frame it as a form of a question. What is the most underused natural resource in America, the most underused natural resource. Spectrum. Spectrum is the correct answer. Over 90% of spectrum in this country is dead air. It's completely unused. Why is that? The reason for that is the way that we set up the licensing scheme for spectrum. It's a system that dates back to the 1920s, to Calvin Coolidge, and hasn't been seriously updated since then. This is an issue on which probably a lot of you at the Berkman Center have strong views. But what we have is a system of licensing in which everybody loses. We have fragmented, geographically fragmented licenses with extremely restricted uses that are non-transferable, but that cover the waterfront of spectrum, which means that it's become extremely difficult to assemble either private or commons national wireless networks of various sorts or various types. In the last generation, the U.S. has fallen from number one in broadband penetration, broadband capacity, out of the top 10, almost out of the top 20. And what that means is if you want to look at the cutting edge of high-tech communications technology, the place that you find it is not in the United States. You find it in Japan and Korea, parts of Europe, but not here. The cost of spectrum gridlock has been measured in the trillions of dollars. Next generation technology can't emerge here because it's so difficult to find the spectrum that you need to have high speed transmissions of various sorts. So that's a third example: securities, drugs, telecom. Let me give you an example that's a little bit more down to earth. That's not so intangible. That sort of deals more with land, which is where I come from in terms of my background. And that's airports. All of us have wasted weeks of our lives stuck in airports. And that was actually one of the ideas that prompted this book, was thinking, why is it that we do spend all this time, waste this enormous amount of resources stuck in airports? The sum of all of our lost time in airports is enormous. Why don't we build more runways? Why don't we build more airports? Air travel in this country was deregulated in 1978, 30 years ago. For those of you who haven't read the book, how many new airports have been built in America since 1978? Anybody know? Zero is not the right answer. That's it. One. One is the correct answer. Where?
Denver
is the only new airport built in America since 1978. It's remarkable. 25 new runways in this country, according to the Air Traffic Controllers Association, would end air travel delays in routine air travel delays in America. Completely gone. And the reason we don't have them is because of a form of real estate gridlock, where we can't build. We have a handful, and this month actually is a major breakthrough for air travelers. Dulles, Chicago, and Seattle, for the first time in a generation, just have new runways online. 20 more of them would end air travel delays completely, but we have a couple that just came out. It's very difficult to build new airports, new runways, because every community is able to use its is able to block the assembly of the land that you need. It's a different kind of gridlock, but it's the same underlying economic structure. There's been a 98% drop in America in African-American land ownership in this country, 98% in the last century. It's a gridlock story. We get 1% of electric power from wind. Technologically, we could fairly easily move that from 1% to 20%. We could dwarf the amount of new energy, electrical consumption that we can get from offshore drilling. We could dwarf it with wind power. But the problem there is that is transmission. We can't get wind power from the center of the country, from Texas to the Dakotas, where it's windy, to the coast, places like Boston that will pay more for green energy. Gridlock story. To circle back to issues maybe more concerned to you, in the olden days, people like Chuck D from Public Enemy would rap over a collage of sound. Early rap music, people would sample hundreds of clips from various albums. Today, you often will see rappers working over a single sample. They'll license a Ray Charles song and then rap over that. That wasn't the change in taste that led to the change in the sound of rap music. It was also a gridlock story. It was a change in the aggressiveness of the recording industry in shrinking the zone of fair use and in basically trying to monetize every shard of every sample. Another gridlock story. The reason I raise all these very different kinds of examples from what you may often hear in this room is to suggest that all of these different problems are the same problem, and that some of the problems that you see in the cyberspace area are the same structural property problem that exists throughout the modern economy, along the frontier of innovation, everywhere. what we've seen in this country is a shift, I think an unremarked, largely unnoticed shift in the nature of innovation and creativity in the last generation. There used to be a fairly tight link between the patent and the product, between the copyright and the song, between the piece of land that you bought and the subdivision that you built on it. But that's all the old style economy. The new style economy is not this like this straight line, from the patent to the product. It's more of a funnel or of a V. The new style of economy is about assembling resources. This is true in semiconductors, in software, in nanotech, in banking, in telecom. In area after area of the high-tech economy, the big breakthroughs come from assembling multiple pieces of protected property. In some, it can be patents or other kinds of intellectual property. The same is true, it's not just high-tech, the same is true in the arts, in history, in documentaries, the cutting edge is mashups, is remixes, is assembling multiple pieces of what's often now separately owned property. And even the most old-fashioned resources like land, the most socially valuable new projects, for example, airports, require the assembly of separately owned pieces of property. So innovation in this country has moved on, but we're still stuck with an old style of ownership. Ownership doesn't catch up as quickly as society and the economy changes. What this means, there's a couple of implications from this. First is that one of the great entrepreneurial opportunities, philanthropic opportunities, legislative opportunities of our time is figuring out new tools for assembling resources, for updating the structure of ownership to have it conform better with the new structure of innovation. To get there, I want to give you one conceptual tool that I developed, that I talk about in the book, which is probably will resonate more in this audience than it does when I'm talking to, I gave a similar version of this talk to a group of Midwestern manufacturing CEOs. And I said, I'm going to tell you about the tragedy of the anti-commons. And people are like, what are you talking about? But this will make more sense to you. You guys will like this. Because you guys are all steeped in the notion of the tragedy of the commons, that resources as to which there's no clear ownership often are overused. If anyone can take fish out of the ocean, they get overfished. Anyone could put sheep on a meadow, it may get overgrazed. At least there's the potential in the image of a tragedy of the commons of that when there's too few owners, the resource is wasted by being overused. There's been a lot of criticism of that model, the model of the tragedy of the commons, and a lot of the work that Yochai does actually is one of the sort of core intellectual challenges to that notion. The commons, we often have what's called the comedy of the commons. But the notion of the tragedy of the commons was incredibly powerful when it was introduced into the literature in the late 1960s. That was, I think, a turning point for the environmental movement in this country. Because that metaphor, the notion of a tragedy of the commons, made it possible for people to see that many different types of environmental problems in water and land and air were all actually the same problem. They all shared the same structure, where individuals were making rational choices to consume some resource that had a collective cost in terms of pollution or resource depletion or so on. So it was a very important unifying metaphor for the environmental movement. It was also that metaphor was the key spur to the push towards privatization in this country and overseas. In the 70s and 80s, I think the notion that private property is the solution to the tragedy of the commons was a big push for, and remains a big push for, the ideological move in this country and abroad towards mass privatization of everything. Why? Because the simple-minded notion here is that private property is the solution to the tragedy of the commons. The great engine for conservation in any economy is private property. Why? If you own the lake, you have incentives to invest in it. You have incentives not to take the last fish out. You keep the fish for next week, for tomorrow, and so on, because you can benefit. You think you manage it for the long run rather than for the short term. What private property does, according to this notion, is align individual incentives with the long-term social good. So private property was thought to be the cure to, the solution to, tragedy of the commons. And wherever we saw them, that should be the policy prescription. and that often was. For example, I worked at the World Bank in the early 90s at the height of this movement when socialism was collapsing, and our mandate was privatize, privatize, privatize. What we missed, and what this simple opposition of commons at one extreme and private at the other extreme misses, is that privatization can overshoot. That you can blaze right by well-functioning private property to what I call the from commons, you can blaze by private property to what I called, what I labeled the anti-commons. Instead of having the tragedy of overuse in a commons with too few owners, you can have the tragedy of underuse in an anti-commons with too many owners. So a tragedy of the anti-commons is a form of ownership in which there are too many owners and too little use of a resource. Too much use is visible. We're all familiar with, we can all, you know, you get, you choke when the air is smoggy, you see that there's no more fish. But the tragedy of the anti-commons, the other extreme, is often an invisible tragedy. It's the drugs that don't come to market, that we don't even know about. Where do you go to protest about a drug that doesn't come to market? Right? Where do you go to protest because your cell phones are so crappy? You think it's a tragedy, you think there's some thermodynamic reason for that, and you don't realize that the incapacity of the American cell phone system is purely an artifact of a mistaken property rights regime, a regime that created the tragedy of the anti-commons. So my hope with the notion of the tragedy of the anti-commons is to rope together a series of apparently disparate problems across the entire spectrum of modern ownership in real property and intangible property that all share this identical structure, the structure of too many owners that are too difficult to reassemble, leading to the underuse of scarce resources. So if there's one takeaway message for this talk, it's basically, for those of you who aren't aware of this concept, to introduce that as a useful tool, I hope, for thinking about resource dilemmas in the modern economy. Now, I already talked about this as a dilemma. There are lots of solutions, the solutions I detail mostly in the book, and maybe we can talk about some of them here. And they are entrepreneurial, they are philanthropic, they are legislative. So for example, spectrum licensing, we have a scheme from the 1920s, and almost any scheme we could have is better than the current scheme. Patent law, largely in this country, the main patent law was the last major reform was 1952. So we have the basic structure of our patent law is one that's geared towards a style of an economy that predates the internet, predates the discovery of DNA, that really isn't attuned to modern style innovation that requires assembly of multiple scattered resources. That we're very close to a major patent reform bill on the Hill. It's extremely controversial. It's not a left-right issue. The main patent reform bill that's on the Hill right now is co-sponsored by Leahy and Hatch. And the debate is not Democrats and Republicans, it's biotech and pharma versus software and semiconductors. The main staffers on the Hill you talk to on this say, as soon as these guys reach a deal, they give us language, we'll pass it. But what we need is to have the major innovators in this country figure out a way that can let us innovate in the modern world without crushing the small entrepreneur. But lets you assemble resources. So there are some legislative tweaks that are out there that are bubbling along, but they require political will and some political leadership. And that's I guess part of I think all of our challenge is to sort of help structure the language that people need for the kind of policy changes that could jumpstart innovation again in the economy. All of the gridlock puzzles that I gave you, these are all choices that we make. None of these are given. These are all choices that we make about how to structure the resources that we value the most. And these are choices that we can change. I think probably with that I should open the floor, and maybe I've given you some stuff to chew on. And
let's thank you for that.
Thank you.
So I'm sure there'll be a bunch of questions. One thing I do want to encourage everyone to do is actually to read the book. It is quite wonderful. This was a great tour de force, 15-minute version of it, but there are lots of things embellished within this that are worth reading. He also ends with this concept that all of what he described will unleash trillions of dollars, with a T, of productivity. And I don't think you can necessarily grok that number unless you've made it all the way through the argument and see how far it reaches. But thank you for a $1 trillion suggestion. We have in our midst $1 billion Charlie, who is Charles Nesson, but now we've got $1 trillion Michael here. Mark, go ahead.
you said in this patent reform that you have, pharma on one side and semiconductors on the other.
Right.
So maybe you can elaborate a little more on the issue and why those two interests are in opposition.
We actually have an expert here on this, so I'll take a stab at it, and I'll defer to you. But as I understand it, pharma pretty much is focused on protecting its current pipeline, its current portfolio of drugs against generic drug makers. So they want to have the strongest possible protection on the individual molecule, because they basically have one key patent usually for each drug. They want the strongest possible protection for a single patent, because they view that as their way to stave off generic drug makers. And what that means is that they are, I think, fairly consciously protecting their current pipeline of products, which is their current hitting their current quarterly numbers, and being willing to sacrifice the more speculative, longer-term development of new drugs. So that's pharma. And I think that puts pharma in a somewhat ambivalent position, because they also recognize that they can see this drop off in major new drug applications as well, and they see the gridlock that they face. My guess is that they will defect from the anti-patent reform coalition if there's a deal that protects. As long as they're confident that their piece of it is protected, they're less concerned. They're willing to throw overboard the biotech industry, which doesn't have this conflicting position. Biotech basically says, for us to raise money, for us to go to VCs and get financing, we need to show them something, and the something that we have in our portfolio is the patent. So VCs are care a lot about having patents of the whatever that small, basically blocking patent is on some particular neurotransmitter. Biotech companies are very concerned about the strength of an individual patent, and very scared about patent reform that, for example, shrinks the ease of getting injunctions or shrinks the non-pro rata, the very relatively high damages that are available, which becomes a backstop for negotiating relatively high licensing fees for individual biotech inventions. So my guess is that the way the bill will go forward is if basically pharma throws overboard small inventors in biotech and basically comes to terms with software and semiconductors. That may not be the most attractive political economy version of this, but that's how I imagine a bill going forward in the next term. Is that fair?
You can also segue this into your own question or comment.
I'll save my own. I do have a question, and I do want to revisit you on the explanation of the drop-off in medical entities. But to answer this question, this is Mike Moyer, by the way, who's my co-author.
Oh, great. Hi.
We argue that there's a fundamental technological difference between chemical entities, which is what a lot of drug patents are, and things like software patents, business method patents. And the big difference, to put it very simply, is it's very easy to tell apart one chemical structure from another. And so those patents have very clear boundaries, and everybody knows what they are. And for that reason, they don't tend to overlap as much.
Right.
So you don't get the same sort of gridlock. Where if you talk in software, business methods, mental process patents, it's very vague, and it's impossible for anybody to really know what the boundaries of the patents are. There are huge numbers of them out there. And so you're in this, this very messy situation of there's a what we call a public notice problem, that you just can't tell what the boundaries of the property are, and no property system works well.
I like that. That's great.
Jim, do you want to take your question now since you've got the floor? That's a no doubt related theme, I suspect.
I guess, in your book, you cited Ian Coburn about the drug patent drop-off, and Ian knows a lot about that industry, and his opinion is that there's a lot else going on, that he really doesn't see patent gridlock as being the main cause or even necessarily primary cause. You basically have in bio, a whole new technology coming on. They don't have business models. The biotech business model is I think the joke at the annual meeting is the product of the biotech industry is patents.
Right.
There's only a couple, two profitable companies, I think, basically.
everybody else in that entire industry doesn't know how they're going to make money or how to survive. So there's a whole, plus there's all sorts of new research tools, research directions, and the science is ending up being a lot more complicated than I think people thought. So there's, but I think it raises a bigger question to me, and this is something I was skeptical on in the book, which you didn't really hit on in your talk, so I was holding it back. But it's this idea that you're not going to see evidence of gridlock because it's things that don't get done. It's inventions that don't get made, drugs that don't get made.
Right.
And I guess for an economist, I've got some skepticism on a number of points. One is I've got sort of reflexive skepticism because for so many years we've heard patents are necessary for innovation. I don't need to present you any evidence of that.
Right.
But, you know, please accept this on faith. So I'm very skeptical of any regime which says the opposite and says we can ignore the empirical evidence.
Right.
But the fact is the economic models, people like Buchanan and Yoon or Carl Shapiro or whatever, or even as you stated it earlier yourself, which is gridlock leads to underuse, not to zero use.
Mm-hmm.
You would expect in almost any sort of economic regime, you may get situations where there are some drugs that early on they drop the project, but then you're going to get others where they try to strive ahead. So you're going to see, what you would expect to see is a lot of conflict about that, a lot of screaming and shouting, maybe attempts at patent pools. There were patent pools in the 19th century.
And there are today. I mean, there are DVDs, JPEGs, and so on. A few of them.
Standards. There's a difference, though. Those are standards.
Right, more standards are oriented pools, right? Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's real interesting. I mean, I think it's an important point.
Yeah.
That people say, oh, they're patent pools like they were in the 90s.
Right.
No,
not the same.
I mean, you had a patent pool that covered every patent having to do with sewing machines.
Right.
You know, you don't have a patent pool that covers every patent having to do with database software.
Right.
And I don't think that takes away from the idea of gridlock. I think it takes away from there may be some more variety. there may be some more variety here than we understand.
Yeah.
I do have this skepticism about where's the evidence.
No, I'm with you on that. Since I proposed this notion of an anti-commons, people have tried to measure, is it a problem? And so far the best research is by a sociologist named Walsh Illinois.
Walsh,
that group. And what they did is they interviewed scientists on drug patent, anti-commons, gridlock. And virtually unanimously, the scientists that they talked to said this is not a problem. We haven't abandoned a research plan because of anti-commons, and we aren't blocked by patent law and so on. So the best research we have so far is survey research, and the findings of that are directly against my anti-commons thesis. So they're very skeptical.
And to his credit, he cites this on 66 and 67 in the book. So
no,
it's introduced here.
Yeah, no, I I've grappled with that for. I mean, I'll come back to any of this, but I my sense is those studies wouldn't get at the concerns that I have, because one of the things that they did find was that scientists currently uniformly in academic, they ask academics, they uniformly say, what we simply do is we simply pirate. We know that we are pirating dozens of patents, and we're simply counting on forbearance by the owners of them, which has been the case for the most part so far. So they're basically acting like college kids downloading music, assuming the RIAA won't sue them. And that works until they get sued. That works until there actually is a lot of money on the table, until there is some discovery that potentially can be commercialized, and then I think you will begin to see a different regime. I don't think that having an academic science regime where everyone is under the threat of being sued, where they are self-consciously pirates, where they're concerned about divulging information because they're known to be, they would expose the infringement, is a necessarily good regime. Second, the best studies out there, this Walsh study, doesn't get at commercial drug development. And when I talk to the big pharma people, I have a couple examples in the book, they're very wary about going public with any of the areas that they've abandoned. they much prefer to do follow-on, they want to have an extended research version of an existing drug or an injectable version or combine the drug with some other drug, to basically do extensions using their R&D money that are possibly extend the patent life of a known drug, but also where they already have control of the underlying IP. They're much, and they're always hopeful to move forward on compounds that they think are promising, but they're not going to talk about them because talking about it exposes them to hold up from the drug owners. In the same way, a real estate developer who's trying to assemble a block of land, you'll never hear about, you don't hear about how difficult it is to assemble land from developers. If you interviewed them, they would never give you examples because they keep specific examples close to the vest. So I think asking the players, especially in the commercial area, which hasn't been done, wouldn't reveal the missing pieces. Just similarly, if you had asked I talk about this in the book, if you'd asked commercial pilots in the 1920s, is patent gridlock, or 1910s, is patent gridlock preventing there from being a passenger airplane industry? They would have said that's nuts. There could never be a passenger airplane industry in this country. Passengers and airplanes? That's crazy. And so asking pilots wouldn't have gotten at the costs of gridlock. And I think asking scientists, which is what the best research out there does, wouldn't. So to say all that is not to say that there is gridlock. I mean, I don't think that I've proven by any means that gridlock is the crucial issue. But I think it's, at least in talking with people I talk with, it's an issue on the table. And you make policy, you know, by not changing the patent law, you're implicitly making policy as well, which is to make it hard to assemble. And when you talk with many other areas, this is, I think, where Jim has an extremely helpful point, is in software and so on, where patents are much fuzzier and much more overlapping. You talk with software makers, they're very concerned about these issues. You talk with CEOs of many different high-tech areas, and I've talked with CEOs in telecom and in semiconductors and routers. They view this as if not the biggest threat, but one of the biggest threats they have to innovation is the difficulty. You know, your cell phone, 3,000 or 4,000 patents potentially read on your cell phone. Or you want to do an ATM transaction, 1,000 patents read on that. It's very hard for them to predict how much it's going to cost them to bring new types of products to market, because the successful ones attract large numbers of patents. And they know for certain that they can't ex ante assemble all the patents that are relevant to any particular product. They aren't discoverable, either because they haven't issued yet or because it's unclear what patents read on that new discovery. So I'm not. I want you to come back at me because that's just a sort of a first take. Do you want to?
I mean, you're hitting a lot of right notes.
Okay.
Let me do that distinction. Maybe.
And then Chris Seguin is next.
Okay. Great. Go on.
So yeah, there's one scenario where there are a lot of overlapping rights, and those rights are very certain, and we see that, and it's too hard to negotiate.
Right.
And don't start.
Right.
There's another scenario where we can't really tell. The rights are very fuzzy.
Right.
There's a lot of them out there. We're just going to go ahead.
Right.
And later on, we're going to get sued, or we're going to get some kind of dispute, and then we're going to pay money later on.
Right.
Both of those things happen. I think in things like software patents,
yeah,
we clearly see evidence of the latter being
right,
much more the case, as you
yeah,
said.
Yeah.
And it's a different scenario. So it's a different scenario because it means that it's not actually preventing software products from being developed. It means that the patents are actually serving as a disincentive. So you're not getting as much investment. You're not getting as many new products.
Okay, good. So you have an underuse of the underdevelopment of the new resource.
Absolutely. You're seeing
right,
underuse. You're also seeing a lot of dispute costs.
Right. Later on, right, to figure it out.
Later
right,
on.
Right.
So, and I suspect the same thing is true in biotech, although
right,
I don't think we're quite there yet.
Yeah.
So it's exactly as you said. It's not that necessarily those scientists may have been absolutely right, but it's going to be downstream when it
yeah,
comes time
yeah,
to for a large farmer to get involved
yeah,
that they're going to all of a sudden face a bunch of disputes. They're going to face a bunch of costs. So
right,
all I'm saying is that there's some subtle differences, and you see some of the clearest evidence of in things
right,
like software where
right,
it's not something that prevents innovation at all, but there is underuse.
That's right. No, that's right. And I My response is not to disagree. I completely agree with this point. But to put that in a theory context, so say you have commons at one end and anti-commons at the other. At the extreme of the commons, you have open access, where the tragedy of the commons, anybody can use it, the open, high seas. And that's the hardest area for community norms to solve. But between open access and private property, you have all sorts of common property regimes, common pool resources, what I call liberal commons. Different theorists call this different things. Eleanor Ostrom calls this common pool resources, where people actually have are very good at sorting out tragedy of the commons without private property. Like all kinds of informal community norms resolve tragedy. People work together. And similarly, on the anti-common side of the spectrum, you have, from private property, at one extreme, you have complete exclusion. Full exclusion, I call it, where there's so many people block each other, you simply can't, you have non-use. But between full exclusion and private property, you have limited exclusion. And those are cases where you have some use, where you have some products emerging, where you have some ability to have people have community norms that keep them from blocking each other. So you would expect for limited exclusion resources, where you have some number of people, but not an unlimited number of people who can block each other, where you have the ability to have multiple interactions, multiple iterations, where you have people who, all of the reasons why a commons might not be tragic also apply on the anti-commons side, and you potentially could have some use, some underuse, not non-use. So some of these examples that you're giving would be examples of what I would call limited anti-commons or limited exclusion, where you have various group norms or various forms of contracting that let people bring products to market up to a point. You have some cost, but not complete losses. So I think that something that's useful, what you do is basically you basically disaggregate a little bit the anti-commons side of the spectrum, and you say that there's different policy responses and also different expected outcomes depending on where you are in that piece of the spectrum. I want to follow us up afterwards.
There's much more in the spectrum. Yeah. We'll move around Chris, and then we'll go this side.
And then Jochai had a question. Back. Yeah.
So I have a question, I guess, an anecdote and a question. I'm a software guy. I do some computer security stuff. Mm-hmm. And in my field, we definitely felt, I guess, software patents. But the question I have is mainly about sort of who's driving the research and who's driving the use. Mm-hmm. So the security stuff that you're using in your computer today to transmit your passwords to your server is using algorithms from the 1970s. Mm-hmm. We don't need to send passwords over the wire anymore. We have technology so that the password stays in your computer and it's never transmitted anywhere on the wire. There's no possibility for anyone to listen to it, but those technologies are all patented. And in many cases, there are several patents held by several people who have big egos, who don't like working with each other, and so we're stuck with these horrible old technologies. Now, the research keeps going on, mm-hmm. and so, there are new and better algorithms presented every year at conferences that build on the old ones. And I think mainly that's because the researchers who are creating those are not driven by profit, they're driven mm-hmm. by academia. Mm-hmm. But none of those technologies make their way into products because the companies that supply the users with the technologies have lawyers on staff who say, sure. Oh, wait, you can't deploy this technology. And so I guess the question that I'd like to ask is, we look in places like pharma where the research is driven by dollars and driven by companies who are concerned about how can this technology be used, how can we market this technology. And so is this problem that we're describing, is this really just about when it impacts innovation, is it really impacting innovation driven by money, or is it impacting innovation across the board? I mean, it's clearly impacting use across the board when that's driven by money. But
it's impacting innovation across the board. So this, one response to this book potentially is that this is not a new problem in the world of patent law, right? The conflict between some big jump in innovation and follow-on innovation has been an issue in that patent lawyers have thought about forever. So one way to describe gridlock is just to sort of highlight the centrality of follow-on innovation, the importance of follow-on innovation. In an area we have a lot of blocking patents from some early. So that's one response. It's not a new problem. People have been thinking about this for a long time. The computer security example, you've just outlined a classic example of an anti-commons. That is multiple patents that meant that, and the loss there is that we have much worse secure technology than is technologically available because it's too difficult to assemble the underlying patent. So maybe an answer here is public source software. So that you basically build it as in a community where people are paid through recognition rather than through money. And that's been always, for me, a really attractive alternative to the proprietary model for software. But there was an interesting Annie Common story that came up, that was someone told me since the book came out, which is this, that people, and this is in the data security area, that people who are trying to write new data security algorithms, if they're trying to build it on purely on publicly available software, the license for common software, they often have to assemble modules from lots of different open source software modules. And each of those open source software modules comes with its own open source license, which is often incompatible with other open source licenses. So you then run into open source gridlock. So even in a community of open source, you can run into gridlock, because to assemble your new product, you suddenly have dozens or hundreds of incompatible open source software licenses. And so you end up being driven to write your own code to get because you simply can't stack that many licenses on top of each other. And that ends up driving you back towards a proprietary model, because the open source world itself faces gridlock. Now, maybe we can comment on that, but to me that was fascinating. I hadn't sort of occurred to me that you could run into that problem, the gridlock problem, in an open source world.
To commend you, a paper that Victoria Stodden has written, okay, relevance to this on the side of data and licensing around that.
Great.
So you guys should talk about it afterwards.
Great.
So go to Yochai and then come down here.
Yeah.
I wanted to follow up on, you just mentioned open source, and that's exactly what we had a open source CEO summit at Harvard just last Friday.
Oh, great.
And interestingly, I mean, this issue came up, you know, the problem of putting licenses together in the open source world is a problem. But somehow what was really interesting to hear there is that they saw the open sourcing part of the problem as a completely different aspect to the economic aspect of making money with a business model. So somehow, I mean, there was pretty much consensus on saying, you know, this more open approach to innovation through open source is actually what's going to drive innovation going forward. And they saw no impediment in terms of, you know, the current glitches in terms of incompatibility, but rather a problem in, you know, having creative business models to move forward with that. So what I'm interested in hearing from you a little bit is, what is the perspective in terms of, you know, you said the tragedy of the commons and the tragedy of the anti-commons. Mm-hmm. Is this some kind of a, like, super commons that's not tragic in your view, given open source?
Well, yeah, you know, I think this is, maybe Yochai will follow up on this, but this is, I think that these are all just metaphors that we're using, that we're trying to highlight types of problems that people might not otherwise see. So one of the goals that I have is to encourage people to think about creative ways to overcome the potential for tragedy, right? Tragedy is not by any means inevitable. One potential solution is ways to aggregate fragments or open source licenses into some private property model. But the other is to make a better commons model and figure out ways to make it easier for people who want to work together to succeed in working together, and to bring into those discussions that are very, very rich discussions on the common side of the spectrum into the anti-common side, that we're very familiar with trying to figure out how to get people to work together to solve resource dilemmas where it's about overuse. But let's also put on the table the similar and analogous and the flip side where it's underuse.
So I promise I'll come back. But Yochai, it makes sense, I think, to go to you after this. Do you mind
extrapolating? This is, in some senses, I'd just like to get you to talk a little bit more about what you see as how you think about what the solution is. Right? If you imagine it as a spectrum from commons to anti-commons, with property somewhere, for property to be somewhere in the middle, you have to imagine that at least in some moment there is such a thing as an efficient definition of property rights.
Which is controversial, right.
But actually, that's critical for it to be an issue,
right,
or that it's an anti-commons as a problem, as opposed to the property as the problem.
Right.
But for anti-commons to be the problem, you have to assume that it's not necessarily property. So the question is how you think about, is it property? Is it better property? Is it a more flexible definition of rights?
Mm-hmm.
Is it transaction costs? Are we in Bob Ellison's property and land, where you can have different sizes depending on the uses? are we in Ronald Coase's improved transaction costs or predefined property rights to assume? Is this about the rapid change in uses so that it's impossible and you're always going to be behind? You're not pushing, as I take it, I didn't say this, just because this is fabulous. It's just a 10-year worth of fabulous stuff. So, but
thank you.
Enough of that. How do you start thinking about, and it comes in all of these situations. So to disagree with Herbert Hoover's system from the early 20s could mean let's have perfect specification of completely flexible property rights and spectrum
right.
with a spot market a la Eli Noam or a Tom Hazlitt type
right.
model, or you could have a commons.
Right.
How do you know?
Right.
Can you think of that independent of the specifics of the resource? And if not,
right.
how do you deal with the institutional arrangement to think of that?
Right.
If you think of runways, are you saying let's let people privately pool together? Do we think commons in land is good, or is eminent domain good enough? What's the purchase on the questions of transactional efficiency, definition of property rights, particularities of a market structure versus commons and social versus market production?
That is a great, that's a great question. I mean, let me just back up. It's basically, here's what he was doing in a polite way is saying, well, so what? All right, so we understand this is a problem. Now, what do we do about it? When I first started teaching, one of the guys who got me into teaching told me that as an academic, you only had two options for what you wrote. You could either write something that was obvious, or something that was wrong. and either was okay as long as it was interesting. I think ultimately this book reduces to problems that are obvious. The problems that in some sense we've known, you know, like in the patent area we've known about the conflict between original and follow-on innovation for a long time. Or in land assembly we've known about the problem of voluntary assembly versus eminent domain. These are all familiar problems, which I mean, what I hope the contribution is that this is an interesting way to think about them. To get to Yochai's question, which is a question of the boundary, right? It's the boundary of, like, is there a systematic way or theoretical? Do I have some theoretical purchase on when the solution? Maybe telecom is a good example. So we all agree that the current model for telecom is terrible. Everybody loses when spectrum simply can't be used. So should the solution be the Hazlitt or Noam solution? Should the solution be full privatization, or should the solution be creating a spectrum commons, where you solve the problem of scarcity or tragedy through multi-directional satellites or multi-directional reuse of the same frequency, or use of the white spaces between frequencies? Or do we? Another way to say that is, do we have a technological solution to tragedy of the commons, to the problem of scarcity in telecom? And if we can solve the problem of scarcity through technological means, then creating private property, then incurring the cost of private property is the wrong way to go. Then the correct, from a social standpoint, the correct solution, the social welfare maximizing solution, to, if we're going to use that model, or the freedom enhancing solution to telecom, is to have a spectrum commons, if we can solve the problem of scarcity, which we may be able to do through various kinds of repeaters and multidirectional and white spaces and reuse and so on. If spectrum remains scarce, or for certain uses that require some central coordinator, a private property regime may make more sense. And this is going to be, this may be, and I mean, you can come back to me on this, but in the telecom area, at this point, in terms of what I know, and I'm agnostic as between those two, because I don't know the answer. I don't know whether we've solved the problem of scarcity. And I wouldn't want to foreclose either option, but what I do want to do is to move the debate forward by showing that the current, by giving another way to describe the defect of the current regime, another way to crystallize what's gone wrong. So either a common solution or private solution, or private solution with sort of public parks of Spectrum Commons within it, are all to me within this, the band of solutions that move us forward. Now, as among those, it seems to me that that's a mix. I mean, that's the classic that's the classic political dilemma, right? You know, the spectrum or patents. These are areas where you really gets back very quickly to the most intense political economy debates, and it's they're debates
which is
that need to
how much to limit
which is how much to li- which is scarcity. Right, but how much around how to deal with creating the right incentives for innovation in a world of scarcity, in which case you might lean towards more private property, or in a world of no scarcity, in which case you might lean towards more of a commons model. But that's the debate we should be having. That's the debate that we actually are having. We are having that debate today. And it's one, I'm not sure that I give you a determinate answer to that question. What I do say is the current system is costly. It makes no sense for the gridlock reasons. I guess on telecom at the moment, I'm prepared to be pushed or persuaded one way or the other, but I still see a pretty big, I think I see some open technological questions that suggest to me that there's room for, that what we should have is sort of have a horse race of commons and private versions, all of which are better than the current one. And it may be that different uses require, mesh networks may work better for certain uses, and centralized ones may work better for others. I don't know. The same is true. The same is true for you asked about the land, about land. We have voluntary assembly at the one extreme, and we have eminent domain at the other, in land right now. And those are two extremely unsatisfying models. People hate to have their land condemned. They're always underpaid. Fair market value is what you get if your land is condemned in this country. And if your house is not for sale, all of that means is that you value it personally more than the market does, right? You have some private value in your land, which is above what the fair market value is. So eminent domain, people hate. So with eminent domain, what we get is communities. If your land potentially isn't being condemned for an airport or a runway or any use, your only response as a neighbor is to deflect the condemnation somewhere else. There's no potential to embrace the assembly, because eminent domain always undercompensates you. So you have voluntary assembly that doesn't work. You have eminent domain, which is always undercompensatory. So you either have too little assembly from voluntary assembly, or you have capricious assembly, usually of poor, minority, vulnerable neighborhoods that can't deflect it anywhere. So you have no good outcomes right now. So in that one, I do have a solution. And this is actually a sociological point, which is I published an article that is the solution to eminent domain abuse in this country, which is a major issue people fight about. And I figured it out. And it's an article I'm really proud of. It's called Land Assembly Districts. It came out in a not too shabby journal, the Harvard Law Review, in April. And I have gotten zero emails, phone calls, or responses of any sort. Not a single response from anybody nobody. Not one comment on this article. And it is a thing I am most proud of in years of work.
You should have put it in a book.
But that's what's so cool. Yochai and I were both at Yale last week at a conference on the future of the book. I get an anecdote there as well, which is people want to talk about books still in a way that articles maybe not so much. So the book is not dead. And there is a solution to the problem of land assembly, and it's basically to retrofit communities with the ability as a community to decide for yourself if you want to have your land condemned, and to be able to profit from doing so by being able to negotiate with the developer, having to create a condo-like mechanism that lets neighbors fight for assembly rather than the current rule, which is only to fight against it. So I'm not sure if that's fully responsive. In some areas, I have concrete solutions, like land. In areas like telecom, I'm much more hesitant because I think the technological issues need to inform the policy ones in a way that I'm more unsure about. But for all of them, I think that we profit by having a common language for linking together all of these problems and being able to arbitrage from one patent pools into land and vice versa, to arbitrage solutions from one area into the other. But I'm still agnostic at the very core level between whether, in general, commons or private solutions are the better types of solutions to any commons dilemmas.
I think we have time for three more. We'll go here to Tony and to Jason, who all have had their hands up. But Yochai, there's no chance. I mean, you asked this question, is there an optimal definition of property? Is there any chance you would weigh in on some of the questions buried within your big question?
That's great, yeah.
It seems like we have this chance to have you.
I think the answers lie much more in the domain of the specific, in the particular characteristics of the relevant resources and outputs, in the particular characteristics of the industrial structure, in the particular characteristic of the cultural context of the phenomenon or the production behavior, the particular range of interventions that are considered feasible and are interpreted as attractive. So I've written my claims about any one or several of these domains. But the critical range there for me is between models of appropriation that are based on relations, and therefore the payment is for human relations. That is to say, software services rather than software publishing, relative to a situation where it makes sense to have the models of appropriation around discrete units that are sufficiently stable to predictably be the basis of a predictable definition of property rights that won't be obsolete. So the anti-commons problem is a subset of the spectrum problem. It's the fact that you get rapid innovation that renders obsolete any definition that in the past was the most efficient definition of a range of frequencies. But the real problem is that spectrum isn't a resource. It's an engineering assumption. It's a very useful one, but it's an engineering assumption. It's not a resource. Things don't bash against each other and fall on the floor. Information doesn't get lost. It's a particular way of approaching. Once you think of it in that, you're talking about a completely different model that doesn't require, not only doesn't require, it's incoherent to talk about it as enclosing anything in particular. For patents, copyrights, etc., it's the core phenomenon of information as a public good and of human insight and motivation, which is diverse. I'm sorry. So so this is, I guess, the version of saying this is not a long-winded so what. This is a question of an effort to engage in a conversation about what particular set of critiques to a particular set of institutional intervention in a particular set of practices, however many they may be, that comes from the particular and systematic predilection to misdefine the boundaries of property and locate them in poor transactional frameworks. By comparison to social interaction running without appropriation around boundaries of resources. And places like land, where changes move a little more slowly and where uses might be more appropriate, and spaces like we're talking about might be less appropriate. But that's the, it's not a so what. It's a let's engage in the details of what are the particulars in all of these contexts, but the particular set of problems that anti-commons, the poor definition, the overstability of the definition, the historical baggage of the definition, and the poverty of the transactional systems, in conversation with questions of commons versus property.
This is great, and I think this is a step forward from my thinking also. And one point I take away from what you just said is this, which is to be something that I could do more of is to be more attuned to the different rate of change from area to area, and in areas where you have an extremely high rate of change, you would expect whatever property rights regime you come up with to be out of date and counterproductive much more quickly. So the variable of the rate of change of an area is an extremely important one in thinking about how fixed a property rights scheme you want to have. And in many of the areas that of concern in this room, the rate of change couldn't be higher, right? So that the property rights regime that you want to have in response is one that should be particularly attuned to that, to that very fast rate of change and be more flexible and adaptable to that and to the particular nuance of that. You know, in when you went around the room initially, there were 20 different areas that people here are working on, and each of them.
University-wide center.
Well, but each of that's part of what's so cool about the center, and but each of them have a somewhat different set of values, that's of social values that are at stake, privacy and autonomy and community that are embedded in that area, but also a different rate of technological change, and they're all going to lead to, should lead to. And this is, I think, your point. Different ways of thinking about what kind of the potential costs of a fixed regime. I think that's something I can pay more attention to.
Long-suffering question asker. So we'll stack up the last three if that's okay. But this was just too good to let up. So I'm sorry to have dominated there. But please go ahead.
Sure. So to follow on one thing you said, I'm glad you mentioned the readability, because I think there's a lot of cases that you bring up that are really provocative that could incite political mobilization around this issue, especially these big gridlock things. But it seems like, and I thought of this when you brought up the environmental example, the financial systems example, and through Bill Clinton, what's the healthcare industry? It seems like the public is sort of acquainted with the issue of gridlock, but that they frame it differently through government ownership or government intervention, and then the issue of gridlock through regulation. So I'm wondering what insights the conceptual framework that you outlined might have for intervention and regulation or deregulation in general, and then if you have any insight about the challenges of mapping a discussion of property ownership into what's a concern about the government being involved at all in the private sector.
Good.
Well worth waiting for.
Okay. Thank you.
Tony, you go next, and then Jason, then you get your last words.
Okay.
Sure. You mentioned, you talked about making something, eliminating the scarcity of something, of something, and consumption can be non-exclusionary. When that's the case, that's great. No one's crowded out. If you can assign value and charge for it, you're fine. But when you can't do that, if you go back to the pharma company and the pathway patents, incentives and ownership over one's product to a certain extent, or rather that incentivizes people to produce because they own it and hopefully someday it will have value. And so what I'm thinking, and I haven't read the book yet, although I look forward to doing so, is gridlock, can you break it down into two problems? You know, one of communication and one of action. So communication, you're saying, get all of these, so a bond is chopped up and syndicated all over the world. Communicating is telling all the people, we need, this is a problem, the person's gonna, you know, they can't pay anymore, foreclosure's bad, what can we do about it? Action is getting them to act. Action is getting the 12 owners of the pathway patents to do something. And normally, I think the reason somebody won't do something is because there's a disagreement over value. So in your scenario, the pharma company says it has a certain value, because it's a part of their larger project. The individual patent holder thinks it's of much more worth to them because it's the future for them. They're going to do something different. The same reason why someone who owns a home might value it more than the market, because there's sentimental value there. So when does one, how do you decide whose value is, whose valuation is more appropriate? And then when is one person's value more important than another's liberty, and how do you negotiate that?
You're an economics major, Stoke, the college?
Yes.
Very well done, Mr. Pino. Jason Kaufman, last question, and then...
So I'm a sociologist, not a technologist or a lawyer, so I'm a bit at sea here, and I haven't read the book, but building off your initial description, what I'm trying to figure out is the degree to which the gridlock society is a description of a whole spectrum of problems that you named, everything from the derivatives market to public land and patents, intellectual patents, or whether this is a metaphor. And if it's a metaphor, at what point you might be drawing it too far. It seems to me that the conversation we've had here about patent law isn't eminently exportable to, say, the derivatives market. It's not like my mortgage resembles my idea, and I can package it and protect it legally in the same way. So I'm wondering, sociologically, what you see as the larger mechanism here, and at what point does this become a metaphor for a larger set of problems that maybe is not addressed through patent law?
Okay. Wow, three great and very different. That's fine. That's okay. So let me.
You were smart enough. You could.
Well. I might see if I can put it away to put them together.
While he's thinking about that, for those who said that they are not have not read the book, two ways you can buy one. That would be good. The publisher would like this. We share a publisher. That would be great.
We actually have the same editor. Lara.
But there's one that's going in the Berkman Library, and if you take it, please return it. And one's going in the Harvard Law Library. So those are two good places to get it.
It also costs almost nothing on Amazon now. So it's I don't know why anyone would buy it any other way, but maybe that's I shouldn't say that. But
my book was more expensive on Kindle than in the hard copy on Amazon.
Yeah, it's weird. It's weird.
Yow.
And we had neither of us did what Yochai did is to force our publishers to put it up with the Creative Commons license.
Right.
Their willingness to pay a big advance shrinks substantially when they fear that it's going to be given away. Anyway, so the first question was on political gridlock. So gridlock. We all know about gridlock in the political context. I mean, gridlock on the Hill is checks and balances, right? We deliberately design politics in this country to be about checks and balances, or we have criminal juries, for example, have to decide unanimously. That's a form of gridlock in order to prevent having too many wrongful convictions. We're willing to let some guilty people go in order to prevent innocent people from going to jail. So there are many areas where we deliberately design in gridlock, where gridlock is a good thing. Gridlock can even be a good thing in the land context, where it might prevent natural resources like parks from getting redeveloped. If it's too hard to develop it, then you can have a positive use of gridlock. So gridlock is not always a bad thing, and it's actually an intrinsic part of what a democratic regime does in order to prevent majorities from stampeding minorities of various sorts. So, on the other hand, there also are negative versions of gridlock in the regulatory regime. So one of the things I talk about in the book is what I call bananas, which are regulatory regimes that stands for land use regimes that result in making it possible to build absolutely nothing anywhere near anyone.
It's all caps.
All caps, bananas. So like places like Boston or Cambridge are banana republics in the sense that there are so many hurdles you have to get to, you have to jump through in order to build, that it becomes virtually impossible to build anything that's affordable. So what, you add one environmental regulation, this, a historic preservation district, you top it off with the landmarks district, you top it off with a whole series of regulations, handicapped access and so on, each of which individually is extremely valuable. But the sum of them makes it so hard to build that building for poor people becomes virtually impossible. That's a form of political gridlock, regulatory gridlock, which is become more and more common in the land use area, also requires paying more attention to the sum of the separate pieces leading to too little. So that's a little bit on politics. Yes, it's both a good and a bad in the political arena, and it's one that people are somewhat more familiar with. On eliminating scarcity, and what's the optimal, when should people have their property rights vindicated by being able to say, back off, you can't take it unless I agree to give this to you. When is your subjective value in your property the right measure of protection for society to give? And when is the right measure to say, yeah, we can take it from you and we'll just give you what the market says, fair market value. When is that the right measure? What's the boundary between subjective and objective valuation? What's the boundary between your private value, your autonomy-enhancing value in your ownership, and the social value that comes from being able to reallocate it? Well, that's one of the core problems of property law historically forever. I mean, this is a great question, and I have no single answer. It goes back a little bit to Yochai's question from before. In specific areas, that's where you're going to discover what particular values animate that area, and when you think you should trump the individual autonomy enhancing value with some larger social value. There's no single answer for that question, but it's the core question of law and economics. And the third and final point about is gridlock a metaphor or a description? I actually do think there's a lot more commonality, and that's really the goal of the book. There's a lot more commonality in all of these apparently diverse, in these all these seemingly diverse areas of the economy, from mortgages to patents to copyrights to land, to say that we live in a gridlock society, a gridlock economy, is not. It is partly a metaphor, and it's meant to be an organizing metaphor, meant to be an archetype for a way of thinking about a whole series of problems. But it's also meant to describe a new way that the economy works, which is which hasn't been discussed, and is where these actually are, there is a lot of commonality from area to area, and we can possibly learn from one area to another. We can learn about how to fix the mortgage problem by thinking about how to solve a patent problem, and vice versa. And we've run over by 2 minutes, and I apologize for that. Thank you for your patience and attention.
Thank you so much. Thanks, everybody, for coming. See you next week.